Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alexandra Metters from GalacticConnection.com, and this is the radio show program for tomorrow, which would be July 7th, I believe, 2015. We are actually on site at the E-SETI Ranch up with James Gilliland this last couple of, 4 days or so, and just having a blast. Learned a lot, experienced a lot. Life-changing events for many of us here, and I thought this was an appropriate time to go ahead and take advantage of interviewing some of the people here. Today we are going to be interviewing Randy Kramer. Many of you know him. He's near and dear to many of your hearts and souls out there who are totally into the galactic thing. But before we dive into that, I just wanted to remind everybody, please check out Galactic Connection's daily blog. It runs 365 days a year. You'll get a smattering of everything from spirituality all the way to quantum physics, and try to stay abreast of what's going on a daily basis. We also have the world-renowned implant removal series, along with My Alchemy and a lot of other cool stuff. So just stay tuned, because there's a lot happening, and we will be used as a main conduit for the announcements. So I'm not going to waste much more time. Randy, and it's interesting because there's actually several of you that wrote into me and asked me to interview Randy, and behold, he and I both showed up at this event as speakers. So, that ended up reuniting a very ancient relationship, I think, that we both realized.
Sure seems that way.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. So, if you're not familiar with Randy, you can go ahead and check his website out. It's earthcitizenconsulting.org. He is revamping his site. It should be up and running in about a week or two.
Oh, no, I'd say before the end of the week.
Before the end of the week. Yeah. And so just bear with him. He's constantly reminding people that it's kind of in flux right now. And for those of you that are not familiar with his background, he is a captain in the U.S. Marine Corps. He's had over 20-plus years of active service. And I must say, he's an enlisted officer, which is a hell of an accomplishment. And this is just kind of near and dear to my heart since I'm a military brat, as many of you know. And so what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of wing it today, because even I have had very little time to check out his background. All I know is the person behind all the stories now that I've hung out with him for the last 4 days. And I think the first thing right out the gate, and a couple of people had asked me this, is can you just explain how you functioned with your parents to get into this role? I mean, how would your parents dive from, oh, hey, Mom, I'm going into the military, to I'm patrolling Mars?
Well, the first part of that is, I mean, essentially during my entire tour, they were unaware the covert ability for these programs to use time travel so that, you know, they essentially put you back right after they took you away. So what we call quantum dilation, which is if, you know, I departed on 2:30 a.m. November 18th, 1987, which is the time and date, and then I came back 15 minutes later, but that was after a 20-year tour. Call that a quantum dilation. So basically, I come back, put back into a 17-year-old body. No one really knows the wiser, but then you're still left with all this psychological, emotional torment and these images of everything just at first not the linear connector to, like, make it all really make sense, because you have all this memory, you have all this emotion, you have all this trauma, and you even have these very real vivid images of these experiences. But when you check that against your linear experience, you're just like, well, that's not in any kind of rational order. And it's that quantum dilation that kind of takes things out of that rational order, that until you understand that that's what happened, you can go, oh, and then, like, really put things in the right linear direction. There's just a lot of confusion and self-doubt, and that comes from, like, did I dream that? Am I tripping? I mean, there's just this kind of, did someone dose my tea this morning? I mean, you really have to ask all these questions, because you have to consider every single other possibility. You know, I mean, okay, so it was Conan Doyle and the Sherlock Holmes quote that, you know, when you have eliminated all possibilities, no matter what remains, no matter how probable, that's it, because that's all you have left. So in this sense, it really is that process of elimination. Well, it can't be this, it can't be, you know, what if it's this, what if it's that, what if that, and going on all those things, no matter how weird or irrational some of them may be, but you have to eliminate them all until you go, well, Those have all been eliminated. The only thing I've got left is this really weird thing that shouldn't make any rational sense, but if it's the only thing left, you know, that's kind of like you have to start from there. And so at that point, it becomes still a lot more, well, is this really true? I mean, you're really just searching of, is this really true? Is this really true? I'm a skeptical person, even of my own experiences. So if I feel like that's my experience, I'm actually going to ask myself that question about 100 times before I'm going to be like, okay. Yes.
Good point. Well, how did your, I mean, you must have been an absolute handful for your parents. Especially if there was a lot of emotional anguish in what you were doing versus where you were trying.
Really, you know, I was fairly self-contained about it and kept to myself about it. I think from a very young age, I had a pretty good social intelligence. So like facial expressions, body language, that look of parental concern, you know, so you say the wrong thing, you know, and all of a sudden people are like, you know, is he okay? Do we need to take him to the doctor? And, you know, so when you kind of have that feedback, you feel like, oh, I guess I shouldn't have said that. You know, I don't want to worry anybody. I don't want that look of consternation and concern. And so I just kind of learned to keep to myself about it and not tell anybody about it. And
did you have suspicions before you were 17?
Oh, yeah. I mean, especially because of physical marks, you know, like bruises in the thighs, you know, needle marks and really, I mean, weird things that if you really looked at them rationally, you'd go, oh, my God, that's so obvious. But because you, I don't want to be abducted or anything like that. You look for any other answer other than the thing that it is, because to be honest, you don't want that to be true. Who wants that to be true? You know, like abuse victims. Who wants that crap to be true? I mean, I certainly didn't want it to be true. So it was really just a matter of, like, keep asking the question, calmly going through this, like, the central nervous system memory, cellular memory, and really ask all the parts of the body, you know, is that the way you remember it? Is that the way you remember it? Is that how you remember it? And eventually, you know, I would say just when you've asked that question 100 times and you haven't gotten anything but the same answer every time, well, you know, that's a pretty good indication that you're hitting the jackpot there.
That's great advice for a lot of the abductees.
Yeah,
for sure.
A lot of people who contact me who have these issues, I essentially lay out the map for them that worked for me. You know, all I can say is, look, I don't know if this is going to work for you. I don't know if this is going to help you. This is what I had to do. Mm-hmm. So try this. Try that. And the people who I've been sorting stuff out with have been finding that in some cases, it's just that simple. You know, I've had many of these subjects, you know, come to me and ask me questions, and I can just say, well, that's kind of textbook, so here's, you know, your A, B, C, D to deal with that. And most of them just go, oh, wow, that's so obvious. I wouldn't have thought of that. And I'm like, no, you wouldn't have thought of that. And you know what? I wouldn't have thought of it either until I had to work through it.
Yeah, exactly.
And the only reason I'm thinking of it is because I had to work through that crap. So, you know, I'm suggesting maybe you should look at that.
So you've mentioned many times about your specific genetic makeup and how that's determined your destiny. Mm-hmm. Can you go a little bit more into that?
You know, I don't think it's important to talk about specifics. All I can say is that, You know, there's no hodgepodge of genetics here, because whatever basic building blocks they took, they still engineered from the ground up. They still went through, you know, sequence by sequence and said, what do we want this to look like? What do we want this to look like? So in a really meticulous way, my entire genetic code was very specifically engineered for very specific short, long-term purposes. As well as I've said to people, a very unusual aspect of my development and my programming, which is to have a genetic and software programming so that at the end of all this process, where usually they just kind of discard people, that I was engineered and programmed to self-repair and reprogram myself.
That's wild.
I know.
That's just wild. Now, you did talk about how you've had your legs, your arms ripped off, and you've literally watched...
Watch them grow it back in the holographic regenerating med beds.
And tell them how long did you see that happen for? Just to regrow an arm.
So let's just say, you know, you've got an above the elbow, you know, removal of a limb. And essentially they project this hologram that has cellular level resolution. So it's, you know, down to whatever HD that resolution is down to the cellular level. so that, you know, normally your cells would hit the oxygen here and go, oh, we can't go any further than that. But with that holographic arm, your body is tricked into thinking that there's still arm there. So it goes, hey, let's just keep connecting to these cells and these cells and these cells, and it just keeps going until it gets all the way down to the end and it regrows. Now, if, let's say the arm was still there, but it had been damaged, it was like burn, bam, blast, 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 but the structure of the arm is still there. It's not gone, but it's just complete hamburger.
Okay.
Now, that, they project that holographic pattern over that, and instead of the arm regrowing, it now is dominant harmonic frequency resonance, so that perfect genetic model of a perfect arm, this cellular tissue just wants to conform to that shape. It just wants to harmonize to that, you know, holographic geometric shape, and then essentially that damaged arm will just restore itself. So basically, to restore a damaged arm, wow, could take about an hour. Take about an hour. This could be a hamburger burnt to a crisp, crushed under a weight, you know, but if the arm's still there, about an hour. Maybe two if it's really, really bad. But a full regrow, depending on the breaks, you know, 5 to 6 hours, maybe seven.
That's amazing.
So yeah. Now, so basically, you could get your arm blown off one day, end up in medical for the evening, and next day you're like, get your clearance. You're good to go, and you're back out in the field the next day.
It's kind of like the football players where they just bring them in, and they've just been beaten up big time.
Oh,
and they
yeah.
just shoot them up with all these drugs and put them right back out in the field.
Oh, yeah.
That's a little bit better, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely what they did. It was just like, fix them, get them back out.
That's
crazy. So, I mean, they really want to, they've spent so much money on us as individuals.
Yeah.
They want to get their money's worth.
You're
they
like,
want to make sure they're
like
the
real
dollar.
Incredible jets, you know, the
well,
okay. billion-dollar jets. You
well,
know?
I asked the brigadier one time, like, what do you think the actual cost, you know, like, am I this $8 million man? And he's like, well, probably $100 million.
Wow.
I'm like, whoa. And he's like, look, when you think about the program, the time, the personnel, he says, you know, in a the program that I was designed under was a program that had 300 subjects in it, young boys and girls, about a ratio 3 to 1 males to females, about a 75% were males and about 25% were females.
I was going to ask you that.
Yeah. And so, you know, basically averaging the breaks of that 300, you know, per person, he says it's, you know, a little over $100 million each.
Wow.
And basically, when he told me that, I basically went, all right, whatever. I mean, so it doesn't matter to me what the cost is at that point. I don't care if it's millions, hundreds of millions.
But they have a lot invested in each
one. It's a lot. It's clearly that they have a lot invested, and that's why there's a 20-year tour, and that's why they fix everything, because they're going to keep using you. If you just, you know, walked out there and got blown up in a week and that was it, oh man, what a waste of money, time, and resources that would be.
So how long was your actual training and preparation for this?
About a chronological period of what we would call, like, if you really just added up the minutes, hours, weeks, months of the training period, that's really like 12 years. Now, that's not
wow.
training over a 12-year period. That's like a 14-year period with a quantum dilation of 12 extra years of training, if that makes sense.
Wow. That does make sense. That's the way the military
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
So it's basically every possible scenario. Every possible...
We're clearly some of the most thoroughly trained individuals in the world, because they don't want to skip a beat. They don't want to miss anything. They want you to be prepared for anything. They really want you to be problem solvers. They don't want just, you know, order followers that can't think, because...
Resourceful.
Well, yeah, what's the point of having something you always have to tell what to do?
Correct.
You need something that can think on its own. Excuse me. And, is going to problem solve and go, how do I fix this? How do I get out of that? How do I get victory here? Instead of just, what do I do now? What do I do now? I mean, they don't want robots. But people sometimes think that they're just trying to make robots. They are not, other than actual mechanical robots, but out of people, they are not trying to make robots. They want fully functional, fully capable, problem-solving, self-determined soldiers that can act on their own. That basically... you know, crazy stuff happens and you're all by yourself. You're not going to panic and freak out. You're still going to figure out something.
Situation.
You're either going to get out, finish your mission, you know, do or die. But you're not just going to go, oh, I'm all alone and freak out. You're going to get it done.
So do you feel that it's accurate to call you a super soldier? If not, where does the misnomer come? You know, there's this kind of definition assumption of what a super soldier is.
So sure.
Are you in that same category, truly? And how is that different from the MK Ultra?
Sure. I mean, that's where I would say that the difference in terminology between sort of external civilian terminology and internal military terminology. For example, some people still externally in the civilian world still like to say UFO, unidentified flying object. We don't ever say that in the military lexicon. We don't ever say UFO. It's not even a term that we use. It's either unidentified aerial phenomenon, but mostly we identify pretty quickly whether it belongs to us, was made down here, or it belongs to somebody that made it up there. Now, once that distinction of where it came from is divided, then it's labeled as one of two possible things, which is a extraterrestrial vehicle, or an ETV, or an alien reproduction vehicle, or an ARV. So basically, there is no unidentified flying objects. We either identify them as ARVs or ETVs, first of all.
Sure.
And so, or if it really is unidentified, then we'll call it an unidentified aerial phenomenon, call it a UAP. But nobody uses the term UFO. And I guess it should be important to know this. I mean, maybe some people don't know this, that in the early 40s and 50s, the public, the newspapers, no one used that term either. It was all flying saucers, flying discs, flying saucers.
That's right.
And it was the Air Force that basically said, came out and said, no, we're going to call them unidentified flying objects. We don't want flying saucers from space. We don't want people to panic. We're going to call it an unidentified flying object, which is one of the most slick linguistical judo tricks that anybody could have thought of, because they're not unidentified. They're identified.
Yes, that's
and
definitely
the tricky one, which is really a definition of aeronautical physics versus gravitic physics, they do not fly. Flying, they hover, they levitate, they do all of these other things, but they do not fly. Flying is an aspect of aeronautical physics that an airplane, a helicopter, something that is using aeronautical lift uses. That's something that flies. Something that hovers does not fly. So the reason they created that term is so people involved in research projects and reverse engineering projects, if they had to come in front of a congressional hearing and get asked, do you or anyone you know have participated in projects involving unidentified flying objects? And then the person being asked could, in absolute truth, not lying at all, say, no, I have never heard of any such thing whatsoever, because there are no unidentified flying objects. They don't fly, and they're identified. So it's a complete made-up turn to throw people off the track and allow someone to basically tell the truth in the face of questioning, but that truth is still a lie and a deception because they're not unidentified and they don't fly.
So back to the super soldier question.
Okay, so essentially we don't say super soldier. That's a civilian term. Okay. We say genetically augmented military trained or genetically augmented soldier, or to simplify, augmented soldier, or to even further simplify, an augment.
Okay.
So in military terms, I am either an augmented soldier or just an augment.
So how do you distinguish the difference between those that we hear about that are literally programmed, where they're activated to go, you know, assassinate, like, right, a president or so something, versus apparently the types of missions you've done, which were literally really trying to clean up the solar system and assist the planet?
Right. Well, the first distinction you kind of make is the difference between a military-trained subject, a military-trained augment, versus an intelligence community-created augment. Mm-hmm. Those are two very, very different things, because if it's made by any of the programs in the intelligence community, it's not going to be governed by any of the legal protocols that the military is obligated to abide by. So a military augment is going to have certain requirements, legal requirements on how and what you can do with it. And I'm not saying that's always pleasant. You can still do some pretty nasty thing with military augments.
Yeah.
But basically an intelligence augment is just going to be kind of anything, everything that you could want it to do. And that's not a nice, I mean, it could be really terrible, horrible kind of things that you could want to do with that person. So I guess that's how I would distinguish those two.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
So I'm going to apologize right now in case I lose my train of thought or I start talking like a silly person.
Because you're running on minimal sleep.
I had 3 hours of sleep last night, and I'm running on maximum coffee. Well, let me just say this. This has been an event that has exceeded all of my expectations.
Oh, yeah, mine too.
I knew that when I came out here that this was going to be a great time, a great trip, that I was going to meet fabulous people and make great connections and give a great talk. And I just knew it was going to be great, but it has exceeded every single expectation that I could have possibly had.
I second that.
And as I said, you know, you heard me kind of screaming yesterday, I'm the happiest. I mean, there's some things occurred that made me a very, very happy Marine. And so I feel so good about my work right now. I feel so good about the work that we're doing. Right. And obstacles that have been removed.
Yes.
And people who have able to provide serious logistical information and support, and just the amazing amount of information that I've been able to sort of report on and turn into case files.
This was divinely ordered, almost. You know,
if one chooses to see the universe as divinely ordered, then you could certainly say that. I would say that, as I gave in my lecture on the laws of psionics, that is an aspect of physics of harmonic psionic resonance,
which
people want to call that divine intervention, they can be the same thing. Two different words to describe similar things.
So, I was remiss in going into detail as to your full-blown background in the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the first questions right out the gate is, how does someone who's listening to you and hear this type of information, how do they check you out to know that you're legitimate?
Well, I mean, again, because as I was discussing the laws of psionics, we've had that conversation, that the best way for a person who has a amount of psionic and personal development to get their truth sense, but certainly a person who doesn't have that much development, their truth sense may not really give them an accurate read. So people, if they're developed, they can try and use their truth sense and feel if that, you know, is resonating information to them. And, you know, people who want to think otherwise is fine, but really, factually, it's kind of this simple, and I've had to deal with plenty of people giving me crap, but I have had an amazing, supportive structure of people who I've talked to who have not given me any crap or hard time. In fact, the only people who give me a hard time are people on the internet, you know, kind of what people I call wannabes. I know lots of information, and it's like, oh, I'm so glad you do. And where are you publicly speaking this week, and where's your book, and how many people care about what you say?
Right,
and most of the time, these are people who don't have any public support for what they do or any, like, amount of, you know, vetting of what they do. They're just a person with an opinion. Every single time I've had a chance to talk to a person in an official position, and without naming names, because I don't think these people would like their names mentioned, I have spoken to numerous administrative-level people in local where I live and where I come from. I have spoken to a couple different local Marine Corps commanders locally in reserve stations close to where I live. I have had a chance to speak to my congressman's office and his aides to file paperwork to get my records. So, you know, people want to see my records.
Mm-hmm.
When I get those, I'll be happy, you know, to show them. But I've been told by a JAG officer and my congressman's office and their aide that this is not something that happens quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be a 10-year process. Essentially, okay, here are some facts. If you are a soldier, any branch of the military, you're a normal person, no classifications, you had a silly, unclassified job, like you're a medic or something, and you are having any issues with your paperwork or your benefits, the average wait time to sort that out is over 460 days. Now, that's if you got no complications. No complications. You add complications like high-level security clearance, special access program, unacknowledged special access program. Well, you just might as well add years for every one of those factors on how long it's going to take you to get through the bureaucracy, because these guys are having a hard enough time. And they're getting processed first.
That's
we're on the back burner because they don't want to deal with us first.
Right.
So essentially, we're going to get
like
got. Yeah, we're going to get got to when they are damn well ready to get around to us. And so, when I talked to this JAG officer at the space conference in Colorado Springs a number of years ago, which was a pretty fascinating experience, all that brass and all that space tech and all those industry people, and you could really, you know, kind of hear the whispers of, you know, how about the TR-3B, John? And I mean, you know, like, And then, you know, and so basically I was, working for a friend who was doing, sort of a setup of one of the events. The keynote speaker was this astronaut who was speaking, and I didn't get a chance to hear him. I was really wanting to set it, but we were doing this sort of setup. And, it was kind of this weird, it was maybe a kind of a weird fated situation, because I ended up in Colorado Springs, oddly at that time. I ended up working for my friend, oddly at that time, and then all of a sudden she's like, oh, hey, we got to do the space conference this week. And I was like, space conference? And so...
Well, let's be there.
I was like, ooh, that sounds like fun. And they had like a huge display of the Webb telescope. I mean, this was a number of years ago. Like, the Webb wasn't, you know, coming out for another 10, 15 years, but they had this major display, like, this is the new big thing in X-ray cosmic telescopes, and they had this huge display of it, and they had this, you know, CGI movie that was playing through how they're going to send it up and deploy it, and it opens up. It was all very cool. So they were really pushing that.
It's kind of cool that you were there for that.
I was. I really...
Well, it's like historical.
It was kind of, and for the number of people who were there, you know, it was kind of like, does nobody know that this is going on? You know, you know, this is a 5-star hotel, and there's thousands of people here. They've got booths and all their stuff. I mean, does everybody know that's going on?
That's wild.
And so essentially, as I was walking around in the building, looking, you know, I was really watching for the patches and badges and pins, sure, and so forth. And I saw a guy. I was like, oh, he's a JAG officer. And so a Marine Corps JAG officer essentially said, excuse me, if you know, do you have a minute? You know, I just can ask you a quick question. And he was, sure. And I said, you know, I have a friend, you know, right? I have a friend, you know, me being right, that who's trying to get his records. And I said, look, you know, he's not trying to be a whistleblower. He's not trying to, you know, make waves, but he was in an unacknowledged special access program and just wants benefits, just wants his benefits, you know, like, come on, he did the work. He wants his bennies. Mm-hmm. And is there anything we can do? And he said, yeah, absolutely. He said, but here's what you need to check with your friend about. He says, you know, you need to make sure that your friend is willing to do this for no less than 10 years is when they commit that much time.
Wow.
And he said, because
can you get over that?
It could easily just not get done in any less amount of time. So he said, as long as your friend is willing to wait as long as or more, you know, 10 years or more to sort through this process, then...
That's insane.
Then, you know, then go for it. Go through it. But if you're not willing to wait that long, you're going to waste time getting into it and abandoning. Just, you got to be willing to give that much time, because it could take that much time. And he explained, it's because of that layering, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, if you were in an SAP, you know, 5 years minimum. You're in a USAP, 10 years minimum. Right. You know, so it could just take a really long time. So, but here was the other thing he said that really clarified something for me. It was one of those things that, it was completely logical, and when he said it, it made complete sense. But like so many other things that are completely logical and make sense, if you hadn't thought of it before that minute, you just didn't think of it. And mm-hmm. So when he mentioned this, I was like, oh, aha. And what he said was, look, with an unacknowledged special access program, you have a security clearance that grants you access to that program and access to information of that program. So he said, let's say it's Friday afternoon at 3:00. You're being exited from the program, you've signed off all your papers, you've turned in all of your special equipment, special uniform, anything that's particular to that security clearance, you've signed off, there's the door, you go out the door, bye everybody, and you shut the door. He said, if, you know, 1 second after you shut that door and you say, oh, I forgot something, and you turn around and you say, hey, I need to know such and such, and they go, what are you talking about? We know what you're talking about. I mean, at that point, you are now on the outside of that unacknowledged special access program. And what you knew about and had access 5 minutes ago, now you don't. And they're going to deny and not tell you anything. So basically, he said, you're not going to be able to request paperwork because it's unacknowledged to you. And there's no way that they'll give you that information, because you walk in and say, hey, I was in this program. I want to get my records. And they'll go, we don't know anything about that. There's no such program. They'll just, you know, show you the door. He said, so.